little background. I am the Mojo Oracle. And I am such. What's that? They're laughing. They don't think I'm serious. Because they are swine. A number of years ago, a friend of Jesse's who lived with us, he and I spent a lot of time hammering out what had become a, in my own understanding of young college people and how they dealt with women and men, the number of tearful young ladies I had enjoyed in my library and among the panicked young men who had taken me to coffee, I had developed a philosophy. And in my chats with Jake Suter, friend of Jesse's, he said, you know, people were calling me the Oracle because they'd come to me at night, you know, they'd come into my house and they'd see if I was free and want to ask me questions about girls. Usually guys would come. And they would say, oh, man, you're like an Oracle. Come to you at night. So Jake said, well, you're like the Mojo Oracle. So you got all this Mojo stuff down. And she said, let's make a seminar out of it. I'll get the guys. You put together a notebook. And this is the current version. We just had one last weekend at the big house. This is the notebook on the Mojo Oracles. You're not getting this entire thing. This was an all-day thing about the nature of relationships, men, being a gentleman, etc. We did it a couple of times. And then the girls said, hey, what about us? So we put together a seminar called the Tao of Eve. Okay, so the women get the Tao and the men get the Mojo because they are different. Okay, we're going to try to at least introduce you to what this philosophy is based on. What the philosophy is based on, and you can give it some thought. I won't cover everything that we put in here, but I tried to put a few explanatory things that may help you along. Basically, one of the big problems in continuing in marriage or in courtship or in dating or in any kind of relationships is we don't know what we're talking about. We just go out there and throw ourselves into our emotions, hope that we fall in love with a good girl and marry a good person. And it's kind of a crapshoot, and it's kind of, who knows if I'll fall in love with the right kind of person. And if you're really spiritual, if you find out she's a bad person, you try to break up before it goes really south on you. It would help to know what's really going on. When you are in a relationship, say you're married, that's a relationship. And you tell your wife, honey, I love you. And she looks back and says, oh, and I love you too. Well, that's nice. Seemed like you came to an agreement there. Came to an agreement. You love her. She loves you. And actually, you're just talking right past each other. Have no idea what the other person said. Each one thinks the other person is saying what they just said. And they're saying two different things. Women don't love like men love. And men don't love like women love. And for not the same reasons. It's not the same phenomena, even. So, where are we now? What can we do? What is the nature of relationships? And in our day and age, and this is part of thinking like the world you got handed, you got born in the 20th century, and now you're in the 21st century, and, you know, it helps to look things up, it helps to learn, it helps to go to class, take notes. And romance, which seems to be, I saw floating around here a copy of Pride and Prejudice. Was it anybody's in particular, or did it belong to the house here? Yours? The greatest novel ever written. Okay. There's been some other good novels. War and Peace is up there, but I think Pride and Prejudice was the greatest novel. But it occurs in our culture of romance. It helped define, in many ways, the culture of romance and romantic marriage. And it certainly defined every romantic story after that. I think just about every other one has been a knockoff of Pride and Prejudice. We think that romance is why we get fall in love and get married. And we don't even know what we're saying. We use this word, and don't know where it came from. You know why it's called romance? Because of what it is. It came from literature, springing out of the 10, 1100s, Middle Ages, Southern France, Provençal, and courtly love poetry. And courtly love poetry and romances that were written were tales of affections gone bad. You know, awful things happening. Destruction, misunderstanding, death, adultery, etc. They were tales of love being frustrated. And the reason they are popular is because, especially with women, is because some people relate to the ideal good in its negative. Okay, they feel more attached to what isn't going wrong by meditating in a book or a story or a movie about what's going wrong. You watch a romantic movie and everything goes wrong. And Rhett Butler finally says, "Frankly, Scarlett, I don't give a damn," and walks out into the fog. Now, no girl wants that to happen to them, but it's very romantic. They want to set their minds on a destructive tale. That's the nature of romantic literature. You go to any Barnes & Noble, go to the romance section, grab one blindly off the shelf, and you will find one long 400-page, closely worded set of misunderstandings and things being ripped apart until in the last 20 pages they figure it out and they're together. It's sort of a twisted view. But we have allowed literature and the culture to define our relationships as if romance was the reason for it, not a, you might say, a twisted perversion of the good and the happiness that exists in relationships. So we run around, even as Christians, with books coming out a number of years ago, 20 or so years ago. Chuck Swindoll came out with a book, I think, called Strike the Original Match, where it was trying to put romance back in your marriage. And my biggest thought is, why don't we just put happiness back in our marriage? I asked a bunch of women, my wife included, years ago. We had a bunch of young ladies living in our house and figured this is a time to find out. What was the most romantic thing they could think of? Just to give you an example of just how twisted women are. My wife was heavily involved in this. Probably actually wrote the story.
That is my story.
Okay, now you're sticking to it. I thought it was Leanne.
No.
But, quiet. Whoever thought of it, it's still twisted. What's the most romantic story you can think of? Well, you're coming home from the doctor. You've just found out you're pregnant. You're married. And before you can tell your husband, he's killed in a car accident. And then 9 months later, the baby is born. It's a boy, and it looks like his father. The end. Okay, gentlemen, strike the original match. All you need to do, wreck the car. That's all you have to do. Get her knocked up, wreck the car. Aim for a telephone pole, make sure you die. Now, no woman wants to endure that story, but they want to think about that story because the presence of the thought of loss, the thought of it falling apart, the thought of it being misunderstood, the thought of it, you know, going wrong, and he's in love with someone else, and makes you feel it's a, again, the perversion of the thing that is, or the thing that ought. Fine for entertainment, not a definition for relationships. Okay? Some people would say that, well, maybe relationships are really about, you know, not romance, but love. Not romantic stories, but romantic affection, eros, Venus. Well, all it does is change the word. It doesn't tell you anything about it. You know that there's family love, and there's friendship, and there's charity, and there's eros. And now what is it? Is it the same for men as it is for women? Okay, I'm going to suggest to you that for men, that the word, and I despise the French, but okay, sometimes the French have the best words. The word is rapprochement, okay? We would say reapproachment, we don't have a word for that, rapprochement, is the reunion of that which was divided. And I think that is the reason men marry and men love. Okay? Men marry, and that also is the explanation for all sorts of perversions. Men have their own set of perversions. You know, women have, you might say, more innocent, they're creepy, but they're innocent of moral indiscretion, perversions of their idea of a relationship. That's why the bookstores are filled with those books that women, one after another, go read. They're not great literature, they just tell the same story over and over again. Men get into, you'll notice all the perversions in the world really are men's perversions. Okay? Be it male homosexuality or being into dressing up in women's clothes or whatever it is, you know, that's the perversion. It's explained by this idea of rapprochement. Let's look at the text in Genesis. Do I have the reference here? Genesis 2:18 tells the story of women when they were made. Then the Lord God said, "It is not good that the man should be alone. I'll make a helper fit for him." So out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. The man gave names to all cattle and to the birds of the air and to every beast of the field, but for man there was not found a helper fit for him. All the animals had been made according to their kinds, male and female, it says in the earlier part of the creation. They already had their helper. They already had their kind. They already had mom and dad possum, mom and dad raccoon. This is not God really wanting names for the animals, because I'm sure we don't use the same names Adam came up with now. It wasn't that sort of efficiency for the... But it was to let Adam know, because God goes into this, it's not good for man to be alone. Let's have him look at everything. Look at everything that is. Because I want Adam to know that there's nothing that's here to help him. God knows. Now Adam knows. So, verse 21, the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and while he slept, took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Imagine the surprise. Then the man said, having woken up, I imagine, this at last, he knows what has happened. He knows he's a rib light. This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. I recognize this. That's a raccoon. That's a zebra. This is something for me. This is something from me. The bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, she shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Now, you all know the story. You know that's the case. Now, this is where it tells us why you get married. Men. Therefore, because of that little scene, fall asleep, God kneels down beside you, runs his hand inside, snaps off a rib, probably one of the good ribs, makes it into a woman because he wants to see Adam. Not just, he could have made a woman out of dirt like he made man out of dirt. He made the other animals, who knows out of what, and he made the male and female. He didn't get every male possum sleepy and rip out a little rib of the possum rib and make Mrs. Possum over here. He made a male and a female. He could have just made a female. But in this action, and Adam's recognition of this action, he says, "Here's bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, she was taken out of me. Therefore, a man leaves his father and his mother and cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh." The reason we want them back and the one fleshness is the direction we're going, the sexuality, is because we desperately, because they were made out of us, we want rapprochement. We want to have that back which was divided from us. Okay, want that back which is divided from us. This begins to, once you say, okay, send back, absorb that. We love, now that's true, every man, every woman. every man can be, you might say, efficiently tempted by every woman. Because every woman is a character in this story to every man. And we go through our life trying to figure out to whom is this rapprochement of the mojo, the signal of rapprochement, the loudest. So what makes it loud for a man? Since all women could be this for us, why do we select who we select? Why do we pursue whom we pursue? Why do we love? What's our love response? And I'm telling you this, is that when we start to find that a particular woman signals a willingness for rapprochement by her accessibility, and what she announces to us as we go further into her life, it's like a woman starts to have these series of doors, and she just sequentially opens them up. Some girls more rapidly than others. Men, because we're suckers for rapprochement, go rushing through any open door. Because you girls know the kind of girl we're talking about. The girl who at the party, little low cut on the blouse and a little bit too much leaning over. Right? Guys just go, pay a lot of attention to her. That's just not right. She's so immodest. Well, you don't know what's going on. She's showing access. She's saying, I am a woman. I know all men want all women. How do I get men to want me? Is I will throw out all these little banners that say, I have points of access. And it doesn't matter if she's Victorian or has, if the skirts are here. If they're here, the girl who has them here is displaying access. If it's Victorian and down to the floor, she just has to step into a carriage and give you guys a shot of ankle. And you get unglued. Because in your world, any access, it could be, have you ever seen women a complete burqa? The Muslim attire? Yeah. Nothing but eyes? Man, I've seen some hot, hot Muslim women, and all you could see was their eyes. But their eyes, everything was in a sack, a black sack with a slit cut here. And that point of access, women's eyes, and you know, girls, when you're choosing to flirt, okay, how big the eyes are, what's that English proverb, the eyes are the windows of the soul. A woman makes contact with you across the room, eye contact, longer than merely she's studying this side of the room. You know that you have been allowed in through door number one. You look back again, she's still looking at you. She is saying, access, step into my life X far. Now, she's not immoral. She's not flagrant. She's actually doing the natural thing, a flirtation that opens the door of access. Now, you go over to her and you introduce yourself. You say, hi, I'm so-and-so. Can I get you a drink? She says, yes. And then you have a light conversation where you find out, through door number one, who she is, what's her name, where's she from, what house she in, what's her major. Well, you know, the basic things you need to know about people. If you start to find out as you go through each sequential door, because each, you know, you're basically saying from the time you make eye contact to the time you go to bed with her after your wedding night, okay, where you get total access, because sex is the final expression. You leave your father and mother and cleave to your wife. And what's it say? And they become one flesh. But they don't actually, by the way, gentlemen. You don't actually. Sex is just a metaphor. The real thing is rapprochement. The real mojo is our desire to try to express to a woman how much we want to be back with them. We can only express it by giving up our whole life and every paycheck and pay for their brats and do everything for them. So please, will you let me at least express the metaphor of sex? Now, we give up everything because our brains turn to scrambled eggs in the presence of this reunification. And that might be a word you might want to use more than rapprochement. Reunification. And everything, if you think of, guys, if you think about everything that appeals to men in the areas of sex. Everything that's out there in pornography, everything that's out there in hints about your male prowess or all the rest, it is all pointed at this. It's all pointed at being more united with a woman. And that's what they throw at us in the temptations to immorality. They throw flagrant expressions of access. But the flagrant, even the sex itself, even the God-given sex in marriage, is only a metaphor. It's only a solace. It's only a punctuation. It's only a reminder that no, you won't. And the real answer, actually the real expression of mojo, is in your children. Because children really are the reunification of the man and the woman. They are half the gene code of one and half the gene code of the other. That's the one of the great wonders of children, is that they answer what we desperately want, as best we can in this world. Plato actually deals with this a little bit in the Symposium. The story of the Symposium is a little bit more bizarre than this, if you can imagine. God made man, woman, and androgyny. That's for the original people. And they were, the man was two faces, four arms, four legs, and kind of a round bagel-like body. And they would roll around, okay? And women, two women's faces, four arms, four legs, and they would roll around like a bagel. And then there was an androgyny, which had a man on one side and a woman on the other. Okay? Well, they got to be problematic for the gods. The gods, of course, don't like people being problems, and the people were getting a little uppity, so Zeus and Apollo decided they were going to fix this, and so they said, we'll divide them in half. So they took the man-man and divided it in half like a cut bagel, and the woman-woman, cut bagel, and the androgyny, cut bagel. And to teach them a lesson, turned the faces around on the outside of the bagel, on the crust, and made it face inward to where the cut was. And Apollo sewed the gut shut so that they wouldn't leak. That made these creatures, man, want the other half back. Okay? And this is how Plato explained homosexuality. The man-man was the homosexual. The man who's looking for another man. The lesbian, the woman-woman, and the rest of us, heterosexuals, are the androgyny. We were divided from this other half of ourselves, and that's why we seek ourselves back. So in Plato, the same idea comes up, that we are driven by this desire for reunification. Women don't understand this. Women have a hard time understanding just how desperate men seem to be about sexual issues and all the rest. I mean, it's a basic comic theme in comedians that men want a lot of it, women don't. And it's a truth. Okay? Women don't understand what's driving us. This is our love. It's a metaphor for our love, but it's our love. Who we marry, that we marry, is because of this urge to find as much unification as we can with woman in this life, even if it's just the metaphor. And who we marry is on who we discovered as the doors opened up. What we found in this woman, her character, her spirit, her mind, her interests, her family, her money, whatever is valuable to you that you found, her beauty. And men that are unwise go rushing through doors after doors because we are like, you know, animals run through a sheep dip, and we end up with whatever we end up with, rather than considering as we go on, rather than watching our moves so we don't rush ahead with just our mojo leading us, we end up not having thought wisely about who it is we marry. We find that we have to live, and as it says in Proverbs, like a gold ring in a pig's snout, so is a beautiful woman without discretion. Doesn't matter that she's beautiful. And beauty actually doesn't have anything to do with the mojo, guys. Beauty is just an aesthetic. I don't know if you've ever seen a woman that you knew wasn't really all that attractive. Right? You know, artistically, I can make that judgment. I can go, you know, she's not really pretty at all, but boy, is she attractive. Because that's when you get confused by aesthetic appreciation. She is a wonderful work of genetic art. Her folks spent a lot on orthodonture. And her accessibility. So a woman can be confident and accessible and open, and she comes across, I knew a girl in our first house many years ago who was not a very good-looking girl. Didn't have a nice figure, didn't have nice legs, wasn't really that pretty. Had kind of lank hair. But every guy in town wanted her. Every Christian guy wanted her. Now, she was a wonderful person, and she had this way of engaging men. Now, never immorally, anything like that, but every man felt like he took two steps inside her life in meeting her. He had his mojo encountered all the time. Guys were thinking they'd found the will of God. Okay? That's what guys call the mojo when they want to deceive you, ladies. And then one awful story where the guy convinced the girl that she was the will of God. He had really prayed about it. So she got engaged to him, came over to my parents. My dad took one look at her face when they told him, and she said, talk to me tomorrow. She had been convinced by his will of God. You know, my dad broke him up. So men are cads when it comes to that. So we want it so bad, the non-Christian men lie to them about how much money they make, and we lie to them about the will of God. We want them so bad, we're willing to move heaven and earth to bring them into our lives. But what is affecting us? What are our understanding is driven by is this need for rapprochement. What else here about men? The reason like male homosexuals get off the rails, I don't believe in homosexuals. I don't believe in time, you say. He doesn't believe in time, and he doesn't believe in homosexuality. Oh, I believe men commit homosexual acts, but I just think they're out of control heterosexuals. Now, the reason I think they're out of control heterosexuals is because we think that the metaphor of sex is the actual mojo, and that if I pursue it all the time, and a woman will not be pursued sexually all the time, but another man will, he has the same level of drive you do. But he's not a girl. But he can sure act like one. And that's why you see in homosexual relationships this almost comic, flagrant effeminacy. Now why? They're playing heterosexuals. Same is true with lesbians in a different way. They're playing heterosexual too. You get a bull dyke and a femme. And that becomes the couple. You play guy, I'll play girl. And it's not just in the sexual arena. It's in the degree they are only answering because of some other twist in their life. They're trying to answer the mojo or the Tao in a way that shows how misguided they are about which direction they're going. So the metaphor is not the thing. The metaphor is just the picture God gives us, one, and the solace God gives us. Since you can't get the woman back ever. Really. There's not going to be some time in your late 60s, early 70s when you and the wife go off on your third honeymoon and the sex is so good that only one person comes home. Okay? Just this new blended 80-year-old. You know, that ta-da, finally! We reach union. But no, it won't happen. You die. And that's it. So it's just a metaphor, but it's a wonderful, soulless metaphor that is picked up wonderfully in children, and it keeps us coming back to the marriage bed, coming back to what God has given us, and it punctuates our lives in that pursuit. It gives us a reason to be married and pursue the quality of that marriage. And because of that pleasure and that punctuation, we don't just go, oh, I didn't achieve reunion with this woman, on to the next. Because we're giving it to us in a soulless way, it resolves the issue for us at a moment, and then we come back for it again and again and again. But that's the male mind. That's how things react with men. Now, when a woman says that she loves you, she's not saying the same thing. Now, some guys, if you've ever been to, I don't know what your bar life is like, let's just assume you don't ever go, but in the bars I have been in, there always seems to be men who think women love the same way we do. They're stupid. Now, what they are they're wild and crazy guys, and they wear their pants really tight, because when women wear their pants really tight, we like that. And then they open their polyester shirt down to their navel, get a artificial tan someplace, spray it on, gold rings on their chest, and they think, well, if a woman had her shirt open down to here, I'd like it. So she'll like it if I have my... Well, they look like lounge lizards. They're repellent creatures. They project how we love and why we love onto a woman, as if she is out there because, oh, you know, I see a guy's biceps, I just, you know, I start shaking like a leaf. I must have him. I'm sorry, guys. It doesn't work that way. You've done too many push-ups for no reason. When you say, oh, Evan, some girls like a guy, you know, they like guys' physiques, like them to be in shape. Oh, and they're attracted to handsome guys. I don't know what's handsome nowadays. Who's handsome? Who's known? I don't want to say any names that shows I'm out of it. Lane's handsome? I was thinking of like a movie star or something like that. Is Johnny Depp handsome, or is Jason Statham? Statham? Who?
Jason Statham.
Who's Statham? He's in the, what was that movie, Transporter? Or who's the current Daniel Craig, new Bond? Stop and think, gentlemen. One of the best things you can do. Here's a piece of advice if you doubt me, and many have. I'm going back to Idaho tomorrow. I don't care. I'll cry myself to sleep, but I won't care. All you have to do is go to the bookstore, pick 10 books by women, for women, with a massive women audience, and then go pick similar from the male section, written by men, for men, with a massive audience. You will get, primarily, Tom Clancy on one side, and you'll get all these romance fictions on the other. All you have to do to find out the way women think and the way men think is to read your opposite parts fiction that they enjoy. But women are not, when they look at a man's handsomeness, look at what is handsome to a woman. You'll see the archetype, the icon of it in the average catalog of a department store. Go look at all the male models, who are probably all gay, but what do they all look like? They all look like they're serious men of business with strong jaws and tweed jackets. Okay? And they all look, you know, they're graying at the temples, they got crinkly eyes, they don't have chubby round faces with beards. They're all very nicely groomed. They're all very sociably acceptable. They're not sexpots. Okay? You look at the women's section, a little bit more of that. But women, what they like in beauty, are all symbols not of access, not guys with their shirts open, tight pants. They want guys who have the symbols of what? Power, security, protection, stability. That's everything. You wouldn't be able to sell men's clothes if it wasn't that way. The Tao of Eve, the opposite side, when a woman says she loves you, she is not saying, I'm hot for you. She's not saying, I can't keep my hands off your buns. She's not saying, you drive me wild with desire to have this reunion. She is saying, I honor you. A woman is far, oddly enough, women, for all their romantic perversity, are far more practical than men in their love. Okay? They are pragmatic and practical. They may misjudge it, they may not get it right, but they know what they're looking for, and they know what the signals will be, hopefully what the signals will be for those things. And they fall in love. You could say, and you might not agree with me here, that when a woman says she loves, it is synonymous with saying, I honor. Not honor in the general sense, because a woman is supposed to honor the emperor and honor her mother and father, and you can say, well, just honor? Is that romantic love? When a woman sees a man who has reached into her life, like a man who wants all women in general, falls in love because his mojo is entranced by this woman's accessibility and who she is as he goes through the doors into her life. Okay? He finds himself discovering greater and greater things, and he's further and further into her life. The woman realizes that this particular man secures particular needs she has, particular jeopardies. Now, the biblical support for this, because I'm not just making it up, not that I'm unwilling to just make it up, but I try not to. Here in the section on page 18, I have a few verses. In the curse, we get a first hint of this. Eve, as you know, ruined it for everybody. To the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. Now, I've been in the birthing room for all four of my offspring. I am not a very good pregnancy coach or birth coach. I tend to watch the TV in the room way too much. But I've been there. And as my wife gallantly pushed out four excellent children, it seemed to hurt. My wife had been through lessons, Lamaze and all that, did her breathing, and you know, she did quite well, no drugs. But it did seem to hurt. And I think Carol Burnett once said it was like taking a watermelon and passing it through your mouth. That's the kind of pain you're thinking of. And it's, I guess, like up there with root canal without anesthetic. But it's like a root canal that the moment it's done, they want another baby. You know, it's kind of, again, like they're twisted. But they go through a lot of pain. And yet, you think they would have crossed us off the list. Men off the list. Hold it. If I get married, he's going to get me knocked up. And I'm going to go through maybe five or six of those moments because he wants kids. You think the human race would have died out very quickly if there wasn't something else driving women to be with us when we get them pregnant. In Peter, 1 Peter, so once the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves and were submissive to their husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you are now her children, if you do right, and let nothing, this is a key phrase, and let nothing terrify you. What happened in this world in the creation, women don't need us because they were taken out of us. Women don't need us because men were made out of their rib. They need us because just to keep this going on, for God's sense of wisdom about the pattern and the erection, he made women. A friend of mine said, well, women, they live longer than we do. They're better looking than we are. They're smarter than we are. Why do we rule the world? Us guys. For the last 6,000 years, we have ruled the world. Women, smarter, live longer, and are better looking. Because we can knock you out. Because in this world, which is filled with danger and with threats, women's situation is jeopardized. Women know that if it came to a sudden little brawl here at the, what's the name of this place?
Black Bear.
Suddenly something was said, like a hockey game. Fight breaks out. Men against the women. And it's not just that there are only six of you. We had picked the best six. We could pick the weakest six. We can take you. Okay? Now, that's the nature of the world. Women are in a situation where they're in greater jeopardy. Now, this is what the scriptures say. It says, likewise, you husbands, in the next verse, live considerately with your wives, bestowing honor on the woman, and here's the difficult phrase, as the weaker sex. Now, anybody who says, no, we're not, aren't equal, ain't the case. You're ignoring reality. You're responding to what the world has said. But everyone knows that if you try to put women in full combat gear and circumstance, the world would come to an end. It wouldn't happen. You could not. And I actually took a poll of women at my house once. I said, ladies, what if, in order to maintain your full citizenship, and you were talking about the right to vote earlier, but the right to vote was tied to this one thing. We were in an active hot war, the draft was on, and everyone, women included, were eligible for the draft for full combat. Women included. No one exempt for sexual reasons at all. You can get out of it by renouncing your right to vote. I think every woman except one said, yes, I will renounce my right to vote. And these are college women, right, capable. They would happily not. Now, not that a lot of guys would renounce their right to vote and run to Canada, but what we see is that we know in practical life that both physiologically, men are stronger. Women find a great degree of support from men when they go through, say, emotional, they even reserve the right to have sort of emotional variances that they'd rather not their men have. We are dealing with not a conflict, we're dealing with a difference, and the difference says, you know, women make this practical choice. I will be much better protected in life if this man will take care of me. Which man for the woman becomes who she loves by her particular sense of jeopardy, what she knows that she has the most present need for. She may be dominant spiritually, she may be dominant intellectually, and she might fall for a guy who's just big-shouldered because she's always felt the need to either feel like a fragile thing or she feels uniquely fragile physically. And she might find the guy who is all beefy and muscular and powerful to touch those things in her emotionally. There are women that are completely capable of taking care of their own lives professionally, financially, all sorts of things. But what if she's a brand new Christian? Brand new Christian, and she knows that she, you know, and she meets a guy who's got the answers, who knows his way around the Word. All of a sudden, her area of jeopardy that she feels that she has got in particular relationship to this man, a benefit that she could receive from him. She starts to see it pointed at her, and she starts to love, because she honors an exquisite I don't know how to phrase it right. Her honor of him is exquisitely personal. When we honor anyone else, honoring parents, honor the emperor, any position, honor those who preach the word among you, we're supposed to honor various people who hold governing positions. But those are general governing positions. That general governance is rarely directed exquisitely at her personally. Tragically, remember I mentioned those bad pastors that take advantage of women? Sometimes pastors will do that. Or powerful men will do that. They will direct their general power at a girl exquisitely personally, and she will fall in love with her boss, fall in love with the pastor, fall in love with this character. Or a girl will imagine that this movie star on the screen is exquisitely hers personally, she becomes a stalker. I don't know if you knew this, but there's no difference between stalking and romance. Okay? It's just one is stalking when the person doesn't want it to happen. You know, the recipient doesn't want to see you. Laying flowers on her pillow is great when she likes you. It's called romance, and nobody tells us these rules. But if she doesn't like you, it's icky. Okay? They call the police at that point, sneak into her apartment, and put candles and flowers everywhere. Basically, that is the distinction that women find themselves in, and they make a very practical choice. We make, our love is magic. Okay? Our love, men's love for women, is the magic of God's creative act. Women's love is based on their sensible appraisal of God's creative act. Okay? Women know that they could use a guy. Now, my mom was a very strong woman missionary in Japan who made it to her mid-30s before she got married. My sister was a strong missionary to Turkey who made it to her mid-30s before she got married. Largely, they never met any men that impressed them. It takes a long time. If you're a strong woman, you might never meet somebody, and no great loss, because it's not like the mojo in you. If you don't need a guy, God bless you. You know, that's how it took a long time for my mom to be impressed with my dad's 8 years older, 8 years younger than she is. But he was a naval officer wearing whites. You know how that is. Now, this is the basic distinction that we're coming to. Now, when we're in relationship, and we know this about the other, women, both in terms of preserving the lack of no temptation or keeping guys from giving them the rush when they don't want the rush, realize when we tell young ladies how to sit in a skirt, it's important. Not because of some rule of modesty, but men are more driven wild, not by the fact that they see your knees, but they have access. That's what drives them wild. Men don't know that's what it is, but that's what it is. You realize that you keep control over your bodice because that's access. You realize that if you talk to a guy at length and maintain eye contact with him, he's processing it entirely differently than you are. You think you're just making eye contact. You just think you're a good conversationalist. He's in love. Because he was given, now, he's probably a weaker guy, you know, he realizes you're attractive and you're giving him so much time and contact and access to your life. What's he supposed to think? He's on the prowl looking for the woman he is going to have rapprochement with. So every signal you give that you don't think about, you have a duty to realize you're walking around as loaded guns. Guys, same thing. We had a guy in our house years ago. He had a strong jaw. One of the icons for women. I have a beard because I do not have a strong jaw. I look like a 12-year-old. You would not recognize me, literally, without my beard. I shaved my beard last in 1986. I had forgotten what I looked like before that. My wife had never known me without a beard. She wanted to see what her husband actually looked like. She didn't want that for long. 3 days was all she made it. I had people laughing at me at work. She introduced me to the house of people I lived with. We had this boarding house, college students. I came downstairs. She introduced me as Steve Benson, someone who was considering the house. They didn't know. Didn't know it was me. Okay? Now, that's side point. No great benefit in that. I don't have a strong jaw. I have a beard because I don't have a strong jaw. It gives me more commanding presence. Because for some reason, either because of our culture or whatever, strong jaws mean something. All right? This guy, his name was Phil, had a strong jaw. He was a fireman, had a strong jaw. And he'd sit up late at night talking to the girls in the house. Our house is co-ed. Talking to the girls. I said, Phil, knock it off. They're going to be in love with you in no time flat. And they were. He was thinking nothing. He was just staying up late talking to his friends. But we, when we extend, things that represent that exquisitely personal protection, exquisitely personal benefit is being given to a woman. My father taught me this a long time ago, and it's wisdom. Don't even pray as a pastor with a girl you're counseling. Don't even do it. I don't care if she's married. Don't pray with them. Why? She's probably there because her marriage is not going well. Her husband never prays with her. And you, having listened to her story, listen, and her husband never does that, said, let's pray about it. Her husband never does that. She's there because she's in jeopardy spiritually. Suddenly, you step in, and you can be fat and a chin of a 12-year-old, and they'll be in love with you. Women fall in love with their OBGYNs. During their pregnancy, they might really love their husbands. They fall in love with their doctor because at that point, everything in their life is their pregnancy. Their husband doesn't understand. He got them pregnant. And they don't understand. They don't ever feel their belly. Here's the OBGYN with his sonogram thing, rubbing, looking at the baby and talking to her about her baby and understanding the baby and commiserating, and they fall in love. It's a standard thing. For them, to all women, happens to a lot of women. And then they give birth and they're out of love again. It's an infatuation, a crush, but those things are what affect women. So, given that we don't have much time, what do we do? One, we are honorable in realizing what the loaded gun is. A dishonorable person will take this information and go misuse it. Women bending over more. A lot of eye contact. Guys asking to pray with women promiscuously. And watch it, ladies. If this becomes a pattern, gun isn't. Want to pray? But I suspect, I hope, I trust that you guys are honorable. That you will not abuse this. Women want to have honest information about who a guy is. They want to be able to view him. They want to know what he's thought of as by the other men in the community. Because they're trying to pick out, and they ought to be trying to pick out, someone who is admired by people that don't react in a love way to him. How has he cared for his responsibilities? How has he considered life? What answers does he have? Some of you have heard the story of how I snagged Leslie from the herd. Jesse may have told you, but she was on a date with my roommate. Now, back up a little bit. A guy had become a Christian in a Bible study that I had led on the Navy base. He went to a church in town, which was Leslie's church. They started to date. He was a sailor. She was a high school girl. And he brought her out to the Bible study on the Navy base, which I taught. And there was about 40, 50 people in this Bible study, big Bible study. I did not know who she was. In the course of time, they broke up. Different story, different tragedy. She thought I was the one who recommended it, so she came to chew me out. My first conversation with her was her chewing me out for breaking up her relationship. I had not done it. That's why I got out of that problem. That was the first conversation. So she's continued coming to the Bible study, even though her boyfriend was no longer dating her. And she was on a date with my roommate, Robert, another photographer's mate in the Navy. And they came home one night from the seeing Jaws at a drive-in. It was about 11:30, late night, and I was going to watch a John Wayne movie on TV. I was getting my beanbag chair ready. I had my cowboy hat. And I said, they just came in. I think they were standing by the door. And I said, we can't really watch a John Wayne movie without a cigar. And so I went to get a cigar out of a drawer. And she had been saved in a Baptist church. And she immediately, knowing, of course, I really wasn't going to smoke a cigar because I was a Christian and I taught the Bible and there was no way, she brought that up. You're not really going to do that. words to that effect. I said, why not? And she said, your body is a temple of the Holy Ghost. I said, let's look at the scripture. So we got the Bible out, looked at the scripture. Don't remember the rest of the conversation. I think I won. I still smoke, I know that. She stayed a little while, watched a bit of the John Wayne movie. My roommate took her home. She woke up the next morning and said, I'm going to marry Evan Wilson. Huh. Now, then she plotted deviously to
torture
to convince me. A lot of eye contact.
Our prayer.
Now, conversation about cigars. But in her mind, she was a serious young Christian who disagreed with me about something, but then we opened the scriptures and looked at what it says. In which, that passage, your body is a temple of the Holy Ghost, it lets you know there's only one sin against the body, that's sexual immorality. Cigars aren't on the list. Okay? That's why you preserve your body from sexual immorality, because your body is a temple of the Ghost. It's the only sin you can commit against the body. Because, as Christ said, it's not what goes into the body that defiles a man. It's not smoke or foods or the drink or whatever it is. That doesn't defile a man, but what comes out of a man. So secondhand smoke is evil. So all that did was convince Leslie that, as you've talked to her at all, she was always this way. She's always been a strong-minded, capable, able to live her own life, able to do all things. She is called the amazing Mrs. Wilson. That is her name, because she can do it all. Her initials, by the way, are L-A-W. Visit the house sometime. We'll find out. But she had a need in her life that I exquisitely and personally met. And as that went on, as she started to think about it, that the spiritual, either the teaching in Bible study, whatever else, or the friendship or the conversation, I had a girlfriend at the time, I think, in L.A.
No, you'd broken up.
I'd broken up with her, so I was really actually open.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't remember the story really. So here's that's your basic drift is that when you girls in attracting a guy, you have two levels. One is accessibility is the strong point of attraction. Two, being the wise choice for the guy is who they meet as they enter your life, who they discover you are, and to not allow them to have quicker access than the discovery of your qualities would communicate. Okay? Where the guys rush into bad relationships where they don't find out how bad the woman is until it's too late. And they're driven berserk by their own desires and they rush in. So that's what you apply yourself to. Guys, on the other hand, apply yourself to your ex. This goes back to the Tao of Steve. Not the Tao of Eve, the Tao of Steve. Which, if you've seen the movie, you know that the key to the Tao of Steve is deny desire, gentlemen, be excellent, be gone. Okay? That's the Tao of Steve. What that communicates, and it's a truth, or a truism, that women want to be in love situations, in falling in love, want to be focused on this excellence, because it's excellence that is of the most value to them. The denial of desire and the being gone are just bracketing the excellence. It allows the woman to consider how little access they have to the excellence because you've denied the desire. You have not jumped around them like a puppy. You're able to leave a conversation before they think the girl thinks it's over. You're able to talk to someone else who seems a lot more boring than they are, and you leave the conversation to go talk to the guys. You're able to not show up at a situation. In other words, you've denied desire. That focuses them on what they're missing in your excellence. If you deny desire and are gone, and you're not that excellent, They don't miss you. No great loss. You just find out that you're not that excellent. Excellent guys who live in the society of Christians, who present in the community of the kingdom of heaven an excellent participation in the household of faith, giving, serving, benefiting, understanding, knowing. Believe me, women look at guys as much as guys look at women, just on different standards. And it's not how fun you are. It's whether or not you are this protecting agent in the exquisitely personal areas that particular girl feels that she is in jeopardy. And she would love to have you around, exquisitely pointing that security or that benefit into her life. It could be in a number of areas. But there's all sorts of things that can be, calamities. This is just a description. This is just an observation. This isn't, this could be, again, go so wrong. There could be a girl who's got this wide and swimming eye, you know, the kind of super needy, high maintenance chick that meets the assistant pastor who's single, and she's got every need under the sun, but there's such a huge distance. She becomes massively besotted with this guy who's super excellent, you know, and it becomes the ratio of difference becomes a problem. Because in real actuality, a close match between the man and the woman is more ideal. You know, a close match where it's a real benefit to the woman, but not such a distant leap for her and her needs that it becomes a obsessive situation. What am I missing? Jesse, what am I missing? Anything here? I mean, this is obviously very truncated. When it warns us, I had some things on dating in here, didn't I? Yeah, look at that. Dating. Okay, Evan Wilson quote. Law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be changed, is this. Proximity plus attraction equals attachment. This, I'm sorry, it's a rule. You can't change it. If the mojo is present, guys, the more proximity you spend with it, the more attached you will become. If she is not responsive to your excellences, you're a hurting unit. Okay? Just because you want her doesn't mean that she owes you like you give. Because she's measuring you, not on the basis of how much you love, and so many guys get out there and they declare their love as if that was the reason she will love them. That is not the reason she will love them. Matter of fact, she would prefer the opposite. You keep your mouth shut, deny desire, and go off and do something with yourself. Make yourself something. Because she would rather have a guy that is a benefit to her, not a guy who loves her. Okay? Do not tell her, ever. Maybe at the wedding, you can tell her you love her. No sooner. Now, the proximity plus attraction, again, the same way, ladies. This is, again, why I recommend that you don't spend that dating time. It's not because dating is wrong and courtship is right. I don't like courtship either. Courtship is kind of just moves where the sin is. The sin and the folly then becomes dads, you know, and dads aren't any brighter than men elsewhere, so they can ruin relationships too. and I don't like it because I think it puts too much power in the hands of the girl's family. The guy's got, remember, he's got to win. The guy's not gaining a son, he's losing a daughter. It's conquest. It's war. He loses territory, you gain territory. When Leslie's dad reprimanded me for calling her Leslie instead of Leslie, I said, well, you named her Rye too, but I'm changing that. Now, it's probably too late to cancel the wedding. I think it was a couple nights before the wedding. But golly, I was studly. These different arenas are not to be measured by whether Christians like courtship over dating. Dating is just a name we put on certain kinds of proximity. It has its unhealthy aspect. It has its healthy aspect. Okay? When you realize that there is a mutual, she's thinking pretty highly of your excellences and you think pretty highly of her mojo, or your mojo thinks highly of her, dating may be in order because it's reciprocated and there's an honesty, but there's usually dishonesty in dating, all sorts of things like that. But realize that that's one of the powerful things. If you spend time with the thing that attracts you, and you now know what attracts you, you get attached. If that attachment is going to be bad for you, you have to remove one of the two causes. You have to either find out they're not attractive, or you have to quit hanging out with them. It's the law. It cannot be changed. And the more time, once you're married, you get to spend with the woman of your dreams, the more established the relationship becomes, unless you cut down on proximity or you cut down on attraction. Okay? In other words, if after X number of years, you know, the young guy on the motorcycle that you believed was going to change your life because he was such a bad boy, and he still hasn't gotten a job after 30 years, the attraction is gone. And excess proximity won't fix it. The love goes. Because love is just a ebb and flow thing. Love is just a reaction. And if you want to keep love in the situation, you've got to maintain the things of the attraction and the proximity and realize truly what the points of attraction are. So as you go through marriage, men, that means you've got to continue to be a solid, dependable source providing for your wife's jeopardy. If she is a Christian woman that wants to see you lead her in the Lord, you better stay ahead of the curve in the Lord. You better be the kind of guy who, if you don't know, you find out. You sit there and you, just like we'd go to the gym and do push-ups because we think they want us for our bodies. When you find out they want you for your achievements, you might want to spend a lot of time on your achievements. Get something done. Because the more you do, the more you accomplish, the higher quality of a woman you could possibly get. Because high-quality women have very few needs for you. Only high-quality men really fill the bill. And my mom, she's a Canadian. I mean, that doesn't say anything. Again, she was buds with Corrie Ten Boom. Now, Corrie Ten Boom spent my folks' honeymoon with them. Okay? My dad's ministry was made by marrying my mother. My mother's reputation was such in intervarsity circles that, oh, you snagged Bessie Dodds? Oh, my God. It was amazing. But she has looked up to my father, 8 years younger, as her spiritual head because his understanding of the scriptures was so solid through all those years. They're still wonderfully married and he still leads her spiritually. And he was an American. Those are the things, the basic outline of these two different kinds of love. Jeopardy and excellence, mojo and access, reunification. Girls, what you value in men. You might not realize that you have a sense of jeopardy, say, economically. You have to watch out that you don't start to make choices. You're responding this way, but you need to examine who you are as people to find out if you have shallow jeopardies or jeopardies that God would fill. Okay? That God has given you certain strengths and God has given you himself that your husband is not supposed to fix for you. You're supposed to have those things settled. And some things are shallow in their demands. A girl who can't seem to like a guy and always drives up in a Beamer and it looks like it's paid for and all of a sudden things are different. That sort of shallowness, just like men and bust size. You don't want to be judged by a shallow appraisal of the mojo. Men don't need to be judged by a shallow appraisal of their finances or their height. It's one of the dark untold stories of American romantic tragedy is what shorter men suffer under. Because it's such a uniquely eternal symbol that height makes leadership. Remember they picked Saul, King Saul, out of Benjamin because he was a head taller than everybody else. He looked like a king. Tall men look like they're in charge. Short men don't. Except for Napoleon. And I think he was just trying to act out. Now, so we could have illegitimate vulnerabilities. Okay, illegitimate vulnerabilities. And these things also play in our resistance to temptation because we know what's affecting us, be it lust or be it bad relationships or all sorts of things that are thrown at us. This is the actual desire that the actual temptation is working on. Okay? Actual desire, that's where the actual temptation will work. And if you don't know this is where the desire for the opposite sex exists, you won't have your guard up there. Women end up marrying non-Christian guys a lot of times because they don't know. They're willing to throw away, I could get him to church. Because women, as much as I admire you, you're dumb as dirt. Okay? In these areas. Men, on the other hand, are just animals. They're just dogs. That's how we act. And we have to say, okay, I don't want him to be right about me. I don't want to be dumb as dirt. I want to have biblical and strong position so that I am the good wife for a great Christian leader, a great Christian guy who is a service to me and my children, a service to me and my life in such a way that the love will just increase through life. And the same is true for guys. Don't be shallow about your urges. My heavens. I know non-Christian girls are a little more accessible. That's precisely why we fall for them more frequently than for the Christian girls. We don't value the goods the Christian girls have. We don't value what we would find as we go further into their lives. We think, like a gay homosexual male, that the metaphor is the thing we want, not the thing. Okay? The sex is not the thing. And the non-Christian girl who flaunts herself, when it tells the Christian woman, I had this verse at towards the end, I think, about women. Timothy 2:8, and I'll close with this. I desire that in every place men should pray, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. Also, women should adorn themselves modestly and sensibly in seemly apparel. Not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly attire. And a lot of people think that that's a verse against women wearing nice clothes or making themselves look good and all the rest. And that modesty is answered by physical things. He is saying, women are not to address, Christian women are not to address their outward appearance like they're supposed to address their inward. He says, they adorn themselves not with outward appearance, but by good deeds, as befits women who profess religion. So if we find ourselves in shallow way, like girls who fall for non-Christian guys on motorcycles, guys falling for non-Christian girls because they're just sexier than heck, because they spend all their time gussing themselves up, while the woman, the Christian woman, who can be a great wife and mother to your in your family, is doing good deeds to profess religion. When you're next time you go to a party with Christians, watch the women who serve, not the women who flirt. Because it's not just who gives you access, but who you discover when you get inside that first door and the second door. So these things apply in a lot of different areas. Temptation, success, tactics, everything else. And we don't have all day or 2 days to deal with all of that stuff. But someday, if you ever come to Idaho at the right time, you can join us on it. Well, let's thank God. And I believe we're supposed to be at a restaurant in half an hour or something like that. Is that true? Let's thank God. Dear Lord, thank you very much for your mercies to us and helping us understand what it is to be men and what it is to be women. What a great gift it was. We're thankful. We'd ask that our understanding would guide our honor. and guide our love in such a way that we do not impose on others, but we also provide ourselves as great wives and great husbands with growing love and growing satisfaction in our lives. In your Son's name, amen.